Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Exist for Now by Bob Howard, narrated by Graham Halstead. 1969. Standing on the shoreline at the edge of the trees and looking out across the marsh, it didn't look like much more than another overgrown lump of dirt and ugly trees to Titus Andronicus Rush. He had his hands on his hips and his legs spaced evenly with his shoulders. To the small group of men standing behind him, it didn't appear that he had moved a muscle since assuming the stance. It was warm for March, and the mosquitoes had already begun to swarm and pester the men, but they didn't seem to be bothering Titus. He opened his eyes for a moment and then shut them. The only change on his face was a slightly deeper furrow across his weathered forehead.
"Do you suppose he could hurry this up a bit?"
complained one of the men. He was a heavy-set bureaucrat of some kind, and his business suit looked out of place against the tall bushes and trees. He was sweating from the humidity and kept mopping at his head with a soaked handkerchief. His complaint had been addressed to a tall man standing next to him in an army uniform. He was wearing combat fatigues or battle dress, and was more at home in the coastal wilderness than the other man. He had the close-cropped gray hair of a career military type, and he had the hard-chiseled features of a man who had seen rough times. He had a general's insignia on each shoulder, and he appeared to be less interested in the bureaucrat than the man they were watching. He also didn't look like he was as bothered by the mosquitoes, the humidity, or even the rank smell of the mud that appeared above the water when the tide went out. He was wondering more about what Titus Rush was thinking, and he would wait as long as they needed. His job was to make progress with their plans, and they weren't going to make progress without Mr. Rush. Titus opened his eyes again and looked from left to right. His long hair fell from his left shoulder and crossed to the right as the men watched him move for the first time. He was prematurely gray, and he hadn't bothered to shave, so he looked like an aging hippie to them. His head traveled back in the other direction and stopped as he faced the northern end of the marsh. From where they were all standing, they could see an opening and the Atlantic Ocean beyond. He kept his feet and hands where they were, but he turned at the hips and looked at the general. Titus liked the guy. He was prone to asking questions that he was smart enough to answer for himself, but Titus knew he was just getting things out in the open. An almost imperceptible nod of his head made the general smile slightly, and he stepped away from the others to stand next to Titus. The bureaucrat started to move forward, too, but Titus froze him in his tracks with a cold stare. Titus had made it clear from the start that he didn't like the whining man who had flown with them from Washington down to South Carolina, but he had been enjoying the man's obvious discomfort. Just to mess with him, he glanced past the sweating man toward the trees behind the group of waiting men. There were six of them, and they all turned to look at the trees, but Titus knew the desired effect had worked, because the only one that didn't turn back toward him was the whiner. They had seen alligators moving through the swamps on the other side of the trees, and it would give the whiner something else to think about while Titus talked with the general.
"What's the verdict, Mr. Rush? Can we make this work?"
Titus grinned at the tall military man. He had given the general a short list of requirements, and the general had come back with his own short list of locations. This was their second stop, and Titus looked pleased.
"General, I don't think we need to visit the other locations. This one will need work, but I can see it. It's not bad as it is, but it can be made perfect."
Titus pointed to the stretch of land that was about 2 miles long and looked like a bad place to spend the night.
"The island looks like it has a northern entrance and a southern exit. When the tide comes in, of course the water comes in from both ends, but with the right amount of dredging, you could keep the entire marsh flooded and create a current from north to south that would be strong enough to act like a river."
"Sounds like you're talking about a moat, Mr. Rush. How is a moat supposed to make this place safe? People can use a boat to get across."
"Think about layers of safety, General. You said you could finance the construction of a shelter that's impenetrable. That's good, but you can't just put it anywhere you like. It has to have layers outside that at least make it miserable for someone who's trying to take it from you."
The general had heard Titus make his speech before, but he liked the way the unconventional man thought, so he listened to it again.
"The perfect shelter has to protect you from whatever has happened, whether it's a nuclear war or a natural catastrophe. Let's call it an apocalypse. It also has to be able to meet your basic needs for a very long time, and it should be something you can protect from people who try to take it away from you. Anything else would be temporary.
The general looked back toward the island and said, Okay, we need a moat. The Army Corps of Engineers can dredge out this marsh until it's deep enough for you. What about keeping it from getting filled back in by sand carried in on the current?
As soon as he asked the question, he knew the answer. Titus didn't bother to say anything.
Jetties, said the general. That's a big order, Mr. Rush. Do you know how much that will cost the taxpayers?
Once again, Titus didn't answer. He already knew he would get whatever he needed. When he and his survivalist group were first approached by the government and asked to make shelters that were guaranteed to protect their occupants, they had agreed to do it on the condition that the financing would be a blank check. Otherwise, they would give no guarantees. His group had also made it abundantly clear that there couldn't be a total guarantee, but they could be close to perfect if they were given everything and anything they needed. Right now, at this same moment, the other members of his survivalist group were spread out across the country with their teams of generals, politicians, and money men. All of them were playing out their own personal fantasies about what would work if they could have whatever they needed, and if they had the resources to make their shelters work. Each shelter would stretch the imagination of the planners and builders, as well as the wallets of the government. Besides, Titus knew they were also collecting money from influential people who would be brought along for the ride in the event of an apocalypse. The general had gotten used to Titus Rush not answering, and he decided it wouldn't do any good to turn down any of his requests, no matter how costly they were.
What else, Mr. Rush?
I'll give you the plans for the shelter. I've already drawn them up. This site will be perfect once the moat is in place. I'll also need a dock here on the mainland and one on the island. I'll add them to the drawings so you can see where I want them. I need a boat. I want the power supply to be permanent, so we'll need to connect the shelter to the mainland by something that crosses the bottom of the moat.
The general started to ask Titus how he could already have the plans drawn when he had just seen this place for the first time, but he decided it was another rhetorical question not likely to be answered by Titus. He reasoned that the smaller man had undoubtedly been picturing this possibility for a long time. If he was really a survivalist, then these ideas of his had been rattling around inside his head, just waiting for their chance to come out.
I need something else, General, and it's something your friends back in D.C. already agreed to.
What's that, Mr. Rush?
Upgrades. I need to get upgrades as technology makes advances. We're going to start with shortwave radio and TV reception, but there's no way those things are going to remain state-of-the-art. From what I hear, there's going to be a man on the moon this summer. After that, I expect to see technology take off. If it gets invented, I want it in this shelter.
The general turned toward the rest of their group. Two were armed military escorts. The stuffed shirt who was sweating too much was the man who was supposed to make the money move from one place to another without questions, and the others were the engineers who would get the work done. He gave them a nod, much like the one he had gotten from Titus, and they all knew the project was begun. The next meeting of the survivalists was the following week, and Titus got to see all of their individual choices. He thought some were questionable, but he had given them free rein when it came to their own plans. He saw that his own choice was going to be far less expensive than a few of the others. His friend, Bus, had chosen to build his shelter on his own property, and he couldn't say that he blamed him. There was something to be said for living close to your shelter. When the bombs fell or the apocalypse began, it would be a good idea to get inside as fast as possible. Titus had been the unanimous choice when the group had selected a leader. It wasn't that he was the best choice, but his personality was so strong that people stopped talking whenever he started. So it was when they met for the first time to talk over their individual shelters. 31 people stopped talking as soon as he said his first words.
Does anybody have a complaint about our government, friends? Are they cooperating?
He looked around at the faces surrounding him, and only one hand had been raised. He pointed at the Vietnam veteran with a serious look on his face and waited for him to speak. He was a tough man because he had already done a couple of tours in the war, so it wasn't like him to complain. The man stood so everyone could hear him and said,
"I was led to believe we would each be taking in a few important people if we ever have to use the shelters. They added to my plans. Now it's going to be big enough to hold an entire army."
"We knew they would have an agenda of their own when we agreed to this, Jerry. Are you saying you wanted something just a bit more cozy?"
That got some scattered laughs, but Titus could get away with it. Not everyone could tease Jerry.
"You know what I mean, Titus? What's to stop them from forgetting who owns the shelters? Remember, that was the deal. They may be paying for it, but we still own it. If I have a battalion living under my roof, they could just chuck me outside."
Jerry said it with just enough humor in his voice to earn his own laughs. Titus got the feeling Jerry was less concerned about it happening than he was with just making sure the point was discussed.
"I can only tell you what we know, Jerry. We are to be treated as royalty in our own shelters, and we have a say in everything. Whether they will honor that promise or not is one of the uncertainties of this little project. Hell, Jerry, what makes you think we're all going to live long enough to ever get to use these shelters anyway?"
"I'm moving into mine as soon as it's done,"
said one young man with long hair and a big pair of round, wire-framed glasses. Like most of the people in the room, he was wearing a pair of denim bell-bottom jeans and a colorful T-shirt. What looked like a room full of hippies was actually a collection of some of the greatest minds in the country. Most of them had doctoral degrees in some kind of engineering or science, and they would be valuable people to keep alive after an apocalypse.
"That's because you got evicted from your apartment again," said one of the six women in the room. "He keeps asking if he can sleep on my sofa until he gets a new place."
Titus liked the good-natured laughing and didn't try to discourage it. He knew they were a close-knit group, and no matter what happened, they were getting a leg up on the rest of the population by building the shelters. He just wondered if any of them would actually wind up living in them over the years to come, or if they were really just building them for the government. After all of the major players were dead and gone, whether they were in this room with him or they were people in power in the government, they were going to be replaced just as often as the technology. He looked around and wondered how many of them would be replaced over the years.
"Okay, everybody," said Titus. "Let's get down to business. We need to talk about each other's choices. The locations, the construction, second lines of defense, and anything else we can think of. I'll start us off by reading a list of shelter sites. I want each of you to speak up and say what will make the site better."
Titus read the list, and as he did, he called out the owners' names. The one that got the most attention as a bad choice was the oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico. The owner was one of their newest members, and he had clearly focused on isolation as a layer of safety. One by one, the other members of the group told why it wasn't such a good choice, but since it was already a done deal, they added how they would improve the plans. One idea was to mine the Gulf for a few miles surrounding the oil rig, but there was no way the government would go for that idea. When all was said and done, the only layers that could be improved upon would be detection and weaponry. It went without saying that the shelter itself would be hardened to be nearly indestructible, but its visibility was going to make it a tempting target. Titus took the heat off of the young man by putting his own plans on the table. He described a saltwater marsh as the perfect place to put a shelter, and the rest of the group started suggesting ways to make it better. One suggestion was to protect the underwater power lines with strong nets. They might catch something in them from time to time, but at least nothing could knock out the power to the island. Titus wrote the idea in a notebook, and in the margin of the page, he wrote that it would have to be very strong. He wasn't sure why he thought that, but he was prone to getting hunches, and this felt like a good hunch. One by one, they discussed their locations, and sometimes there were ideas that could be referred back to each previously discussed shelter. Someone came up with the concept that there should be a decoy shelter somewhere nearby. That way, people would never suspect there was something bigger and better only a short distance away. That worked for everyone, including the oil rig. It wasn't hard to imagine that plenty of people would try to escape to the rigs. They just had to find ways to keep them from getting inside. The meeting ended with a plan to return in a month with progress reports. Titus told everyone that he expected to hear that all of the shelters were at least habitable by the end of the year. With the exception of the shelter at Fort Sumter, he was sure it could be done. The next time Titus Rush visited his chosen shelter site, he was surprised to see the amount of progress the Army Corps of Engineers had made. He had at least half expected to find there had been delays. Money would be tied up by some pending house bill, or some auditor had questioned the manpower and materials. Instead, he found they were ahead of schedule. He seriously doubted they could be making the same progress on 31 more shelters. When Titus had selected the site, he had been standing at a tree line on a narrow strip of ground that gently sloped down into marsh grass and mud. As he stepped from the trees, he found himself standing on a sandy beach, and about 20 yards in front of him was a cliff. He eased forward and looked over the edge. Wooden framework was holding the beach in place, or it would have all collapsed into a trench that was at least 50 feet deep near the beach. Toward the middle of the trench, it was closer to 100 feet deep, and at the bottom, he could see men working on power cables. The far shoreline looked smooth and metallic, and a second group of men was working on metal fasteners for a pair of the biggest nets he had ever seen. The nets were stretched across the bottom of the trench, ready to be raised into place. The general hadn't balked in the slightest when he had called to suggest the additional layers of protection. An army engineer walked up to him and said, "Mr. Rush, you're just in time for the big show. We'll be pulling back the men and equipment in a few minutes, and the crews at the dams will be letting the water in from both ends. You might want to be back by the trees when the two waves meet in the middle." He watched as the crews finished in the deep trench and were hauled to the shore. He realized the only way they could have dug such a deep trench was to dam entrances at the ends of the island, and the nets were too heavy to put in place without cranes, so they would use the water to float them into place. "Have you guys gotten much done on the shelter?" he asked the engineer. He smiled proudly and said, "You won't believe it, sir. As a matter of fact, our crew is competing with the other crews to see who can build the best shelter." In the distance, sirens started to wail, and everyone who was working on the island and the mainland got into position to watch the water fill the moat. It was as impressive as the young army engineer had expected. The two waves crashed into each other, and for a few moments it looked like a raging sea in the moat. When it finally began to settle, there was a wide river where there had once been nothing but mud and grass. A boat came around the northern end of the island and was making its way toward the shore where Titus was standing. The officer driving the boat let it turn sideways so it would drift up to the bank where the wooden framework was. He waved for Titus to jump aboard and immediately turned back toward the island.
"We're going to build a dock on the mainland right where you were standing," he shouted over the sound of the twin outboard engines. "The general said he wants the dock rebuilt every 10 years. If you ever have to use this place, you'll need the dock with the boat ready for the trip across."
As they approached the northern tip of the island, Titus could see a dock already protruding out from the land, and the officer expertly coasted up to it. Titus was fixated on the stone jetty that sat across from the entrance to the moat, and all he could think was how quickly they had done the work. It crossed his mind that the people in Washington might have been expecting something big.
"Is the jetty already done on the southern end of the island?" he asked.
"Certainly is, sir. It was better to have them both done before letting in the water. That way neither end would need to be dredged. As you leave the entrances to the moat, the bottom gets much more shallow, but it's still deep enough to draft big boats."
Titus followed the man as they left the dock and began hiking along a rough path toward the center of the island. His ankles were a little sore from the constant changes in the ground, and he was just about to ask the officer how much further when they walked into a small clearing. In front of them, set neatly in a recessed wall of earth, was the biggest bank vault door he had ever seen. It was standing open, and the sounds of construction could be heard coming from deep inside the island.
"Can we go in?" he asked.
The officer smiled and made a sweeping gesture toward the door with one hand.
"Make yourself at home, Mr. Rush. It belongs to you."
Titus felt like a kid again. He stepped over the bottom edge of the door sill and looked around. At first he was a little disappointed because the room was so small, but then he realized the construction noises were coming from somewhere below.
"The rooms are far from finished, Mr. Rush, but I'm sure you'll appreciate them even more when you know what's underneath the finished product. For now, we'd like you to see some of the safety features and layouts. We've read your specifications, and we think you will like what you see."
For the next hour, Titus Andronicus Rush roamed from room to room, studying every little detail, thinking the entire time,
"Oh, yes, I really do like this, even though the master bedroom is in the wrong place."
Life goes on. None of us really knew what it would be like to shut the door and actually have to keep it shut. It had always been an option to go outside, and the promise of fresh air and sunshine had made the shelter inside Mud Island feel like home. When the door was sealed, it felt more like a tomb. It was too quiet in the first few minutes. We all looked at each other and realized the finality of our situation. We had no way of knowing how bad the nuclear incident was, so we also didn't know how long it would last. We didn't know what would be safe when we went outside, where we could go, and where the contamination would be. There were plenty of questions, and very few answers. No one spoke as we drifted off into our own private pursuits. Jean was experimenting with bread dough again. Kathy was looking through the supply of books, and the chief had disappeared somewhere below, probably to the armory. Tom had gone in the same direction as he pulled on weightlifting gloves. Molly was sitting at the radio, wearing the headphones that always looked too big on her head. Buss had already claimed his right to the computer and was reading an article about radiation exposure. Not immediately knowing what I wanted to do with my time, I considered putting a video game on the main screen, but somehow I felt like being a little more productive. I switched on the outside video monitors and started scanning the different views. It didn't take me too long to realize there was a reason I had turned to what was happening outside instead of finding something to do inside. Changes were about to happen again. What the changes would be were unknown, but they were coming. It slowly sank in that I was hoping to see the infected dead fall over and stay dead when the radiation dropped on the coast of South Carolina. Buss was the one who had the foresight to put radiation monitors in several locations on the dock, all within view of cameras. He had even put one in the houseboat so we could judge how bad it got in a place that had minimal protection. All of them were still reading normal, which was good news. That meant the radiation hadn't arrived before we got inside. I absentmindedly listened as Molly raised Fort Sumter on her radio. From what I could tell, she was talking with Sam. I remembered having a crush on a girl when I was about the same age, and it seemed to be that much stronger because we couldn't see each other whenever we wanted to. It was a long-distance relationship, and the internet was just beginning to be a way to shorten the distance. I imagined their relationship might be ready to burst by the time they were able to see each other. My attention was drawn back to the outside views, and I watched a pair of the infected dead walk out of the trees. It slowly dawned on me that I wanted the radiation to arrive. I wanted to see it for myself and to know how the radiation would affect them. I wanted to see them double over and collapse into the sand. I held my breath and waited, but nothing happened. All they did was the usual lurching and stumbling through the sand until they eventually reached the edge of the moat and fell in. I glanced over at the screen that showed the radiation monitors, and there was still no change. At least it looked like there wasn't. There were two different monitors at each location. One changed colors, and one had a needle that traveled along a calibrated arc. I wasn't entirely sure, but it looked like the needle wasn't sitting on top of the line that meant zero. It was starting.
"Uncle Eddie?"
Molly was holding the headphones away from her ears.
"Captain Miller said to tell you they were reading low levels of radiation. He wants to know if we are, too."
"Tell him we are, Molly. Nothing big yet, but it's starting." Molly nodded at me and turned back to the radio. I went back to scanning the trees on the mainland. There wasn't much breeze blowing, but I could imagine the radiation moving through the air. It would be even more deadly out there than what it had been when the infection started. Now there was just one more thing in the world that would start killing people who had somehow survived the teeth of the infected dead. Jean came in from the kitchen and sat down next to me.
"Dough has to rise for a while," she said. "What's happening outside?"
I had expected her to say something funny, which is what she probably would have done under normal circumstances, but the gravity of the radiation falling unseen outside was having a sobering effect on everyone. "It's starting. The radiation monitors are starting to react." We both looked at the screens and saw the needles had all moved further along their arcs, and the colored monitors were a slight shade of pink. All we could do was sit and watch, as if they were going to suddenly reverse direction.
"You know, Eddie, this is what your uncle really had in mind when he built this shelter. Someone was supposed to press a red button somewhere or turn a big key, and everyone who didn't get blown up was supposed to be killed by fallout."
It wasn't like Jean to be so negative, and I wondered what she was thinking. Maybe I was finally starting to grow up, because I could see what was bothering her in her expression. It was the way she was looking at the monitors. "Are you feeling guilty about being safe inside Mud Island?"
"A little. Someone else was supposed to be here, but they didn't make it. Look at the number of times we've managed to stay alive, and some poor slob couldn't even survive once by making it to the shelter."
"Do you think we don't deserve to be here?" I asked. Jean was so caught up in her feelings, and I was so sorry to see her having a down moment, that we almost didn't see the small boat that had pulled up to the dock. There were at least 6 people, and if we weren't already feeling guilty enough, there were a couple of toddlers being carried by the adults. They were rushing to get inside the houseboat as if they knew something was wrong outside. This time, Jean read my mind and said,
"They must have a radio. That has to be how they know about the radiation. But if they do, then they already know it's too late."
I reached over to the controls and turned off the monitors to the inside of the houseboat. We knew what was going to happen to the people, and there wasn't any sense in watching it happen. Jean squeezed my hand and got up from the sofa.
"I'm going to go do something to keep busy, Eddie. I can't let myself think about what's happening out there."
I couldn't do anything to help Jean or the new arrivals, and there really wasn't anything to be learned from watching them slowly die from the radiation poisoning. I didn't know how wrong I was. We gradually got used to the idea that we were going to be locked inside Mud Island for a long time. Routines began to take shape, and schedules became normal. It wasn't that we sat down and decided what would get done and when. We just started doing the same things at the same times until it became expected. Kathy started a running club, and within a few weeks we were all doing our time on the treadmills as a group. Even Jean, as pregnant as she was, managed to keep up for a while. We got daily reports from Fort Sumter, and the Army had the same dismal updates we had for them. As expected, people moved into the fort above the shelter, and someone had taken up residence in the Cormorant, the Coast Guard ship that had saved our lives. It wasn't long before people started to show signs of radiation sickness. Captain Miller usually took care of the call himself, seeming to draw strength from knowing his rescuers were safe inside their own shelter. I overheard him saying to the chief that he owed him for his life twice now. If not for the Mud Island group, they would have been stuck outside in the radioactive fallout. Of course, the chief didn't want any part of the credit. He told Captain Miller we didn't do anything they wouldn't have done for us. Jean started turning out some pretty good fresh-baked bread, and the supplies were holding up better than we could have hoped. Time started slipping by without monotony setting in. There just seemed to be enough to keep us busy. It was over breakfast when the chief was in the middle of a conversation with Tom, and I was working on a stack of pancakes without much thought for what they were discussing. That was when he decided to have a little fun with me. Jean was setting Molly up with a fresh glass of her beloved chocolate milk, although it was being poured from a can, and Kathy was having a dispute with Bus over the merits of coffee, because Bus preferred tea. The chief brought the room to a standstill.
"So, Ed, when do you plan to make an honest woman out of Jean?"
True to his usual form, he covered his grin by putting his coffee cup to his mouth. The mischief was still there in the pair of eyes above the steaming coffee. Not to be outdone, and I have to give myself some credit, I'd gotten pretty good at defending myself from the chief's...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?